places you'll go. Hello, and welcome to the After JET podcast, featuring stories and careers of people who did the JET exchange program to Japan, like me. You know, talking to people for this podcast reminds me sometimes of that poem by Dr. Seuss, and my guest, Sam Baldwin, is one of those people who have been to many places in his career. From the pharmaceutical industry, dabbling in fashion, working in tech startups, to being a journalist and a published author. Basically, his resume is an impressive list of someone who has done stuff with a capital S. And it's also a physical journey. Sam now works in Slovenia, thanks to his lifelong pursuit of the outdoors life in snowy mountain lands. He chronicles his journey and his love for his adopted country in his latest book called Dormice and Moonshine, Falling for Slovenia. And to be honest, listening to his description of the place, it's making me curious about visiting Slovenia. So, road trip anyone? See you at the end. Enjoy!
My name's Sam Baldwin, and I am currently a freelance writer, author, and content marketer. I was in Fukui Prefecture for 2 years, 20 years ago, actually, now. It's a long time ago. Fukui Prefecture, for those who don't know, it's on Honshu. If you went directly west of Tokyo, you'd hit Fukui, but it's maybe not one of the better known places. I would say Fukui is a hidden gem of Japan. That's a cliche, but I think it's quite an authentically Japanese place because it's not really very popular tourist-wise in general, even within for Japanese. You know, if you're going to go to Japan for 2 weeks, you're unlikely to visit Fukui Prefecture. And I think that makes it, yeah, a little bit more authentic and maybe more interesting and more untouched.
Yeah, this ended up writing how many books? One book? On your time in Fukui. For Fukui's sake, 2 years in rural Japan. So obviously there was something there that was enough for one book, for one memoir.
Yeah, absolutely. Although at first I was a little disappointed about Fukui. When I researched it, it seemed to be famous for nuclear reactors, a famous suicide spot on the coast. You know, there wasn't particularly great. But however, I was placed in a small town called Ono, which is encircled by mountains. And this turned out to be the absolute heaven for me. For someone who's into mountains and the outdoors and wanted to explore that side of life, it was perfect. And so, yeah, the book, For Fukui's Sake, it's less about the classroom experience of being a JET, although I do cover that a little bit. But it was more about living and meeting locals and getting out and exploring the natural world of Japan. And there was plenty of it in Fukui. I ended up meeting very interesting people. I ended up meeting a guy who ran a bar who was also a kind of really into mountain climbing. So he showed me all of these great routes around Fukui. I joined my school's cross-country ski club, skiing over these snow-covered rice paddies. I learned that. And it was just a great place to really experience the great outdoors. So it was really, really good for me.
Awesome. So going on to your career arc, I thought I had a bit of a meandering career journey, but I don't think it's got anything on you. From copywriting, comms and marketing, travel writing, fashion designer, author of several books, including your latest called, is it Dormice or Dormice?
Dormice and Moonshine.
Dormice and Moonshine, Falling for Slovenia. And we'll get to the book, of course, but I want to talk a bit about your career path or attempt to wrestle with that. You straddle several very different disciplines here. For example, you were part of a tech setup. At one point, you launched like an AI-powered keyboard, I believe, and you've done quite a lot of journalism. And what I see when looking at your career path is that you're no stranger to taking risks, like making those big decisions that would terrify most of us. What helps you? What drives you forward in that sort of area?
It's a big question. I think it probably depends on each decision that I've come to. But if we take it in the lens of my career, you're right. I've had quite a meandering road. I studied pharmacology at university, which is the study of drugs. And after the ski season in Canada, I came back to the UK and I thought I need to get a proper job, a so-called proper job. So I ended up working in a laboratory for about 2 years, but it became apparent quite quickly that that wasn't what I wanted to do. So I was kind of mid-20s at this time. And that's when I started thinking about, well, what's my next move? I still wanted to see more of the world. And that's when I heard about Japan, because a friend of mine was doing JET at the time and he was sending me these pictures of this incredible snowfall. And that's when I set my eyes on Japan. So for that, for example, that decision, what drove that was that there was sort of a set of push factors and pull factors. So the push factors were, I wasn't particularly enjoying my job. I didn't really see my future being in that laboratory for the next 35 years or whatever until I retired. And then the pull factors were, well, here's this opportunity that I could maybe go to Japan and experience this completely different place and live somewhere different again, as I already had once, and have this mountainous snow experience. It's interesting you say that it might scare a lot of people. And that's something I definitely got, because I remember when I told my colleagues that I was going to go to Japan, a lot of their kind of attitude was that, oh, that sounds nice, but what are you going to do when you get back? You know, what about your job? And get it out of your system, you know, take it a year out.
Yeah. It was your gap year, basically. Yeah.
Exactly. But I'd already kind of done a so-called gap year previously. So for me, it wasn't like it was a little break and then I come back to my normal life. It was, let's completely change my direction and see what happens. And that is, there is a leap of faith you do have to take there. And I think what I learned from the Japan experience is that taking those jumps into the unknown always pays off. And there's something I think is interesting. I call it the law of hidden doors. And that is that there's all these doors of opportunities out in the big wide world. But for most of them, you cannot go through those doors, let alone even see that they exist, unless you physically go somewhere. Because once you go somewhere, you see it differently, you see it more closely, you start to meet people. And through meeting those people, new doors of opportunities appear. And that's exactly what happened to me with my JET experience, because going there led me into writing and eventually into sort of growth marketing and content marketing.
And going back to your career path, there's not been a kind of a plan, I suppose, because it's sort of, let's see what happens next kind of thing, which, you know, that's also been my guiding principle. I've never been really one to plan things out.
Yeah, you're right. I never had a career plan, so to speak. My opinion is that's almost impossible to plan very far out anyway, because there's too many unknown factors in life that you really can't plan that far, because there's something will come up which completely means you have to alter your plan. What you can do, and I think what I did, was I started to realize what sort of lifestyle I wanted. So that year in Canada, working in the mountains, then a little bit later, those 2 years in Japan, again, working in a mountainous, outdoorsy kind of place, that solidified the idea that I wanted to live that sort of mountain lifestyle. And you have to remember, someone from the UK, we don't have mountains of any great height. Living in Canada, living in Japan, it made me realize you can actually do this. You can live in a mountainous area. You can have this lifestyle. So I think my plan has been more about how can I engineer my life to live this outdoors, mountainous lifestyle that I really love. And I think I couldn't really do that in England. And it took me a long time, but that's actually why I ended up, I'm right now speaking to you from a small cabin on the side of a Slovenian mountainside. There's about 30 centimeters of snow out the window. So yeah, I got there in the end, although it took many years to get there.
So let's talk about Slovenia. Where is it in Slovenia that you live now?
Well, actually, I just recently moved just over the border from Slovenia. Slovenia, for those who maybe don't know, it's surrounded by Italy, Austria, Hungary, and Croatia. And I moved just over the border into Austria because I met an Austrian woman in my Slovene class a few years ago, and eventually we kind of had to live in the same country. But it's so close. I live about 20 minutes from the border, so I'm always in Slovenia. But I spent 5 years living in the capital of Slovenia, which is called Ljubljana. It's a beautiful city. For me, it's the best city in the world. It suits the lifestyle that I want. And Slovenia as a country is an incredible place. It's very much under the radar still. But it's, again, for somebody who likes the outdoors, it's an absolute paradise. In a nutshell, I wanted to move my life somewhere more conducive to this outdoor lifestyle that I loved. And my brother also spent a year in Canada working at the same ski area in British Columbia. He loved this lifestyle as well. Back in our 20s, we started sort of talking about, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if one day we had a little cabin up in a mountain somewhere? It was just a dream. It was just a silly dream that we would occasionally talk about over a beer, but it wasn't really, we didn't really pursue it. And then after a few years, we started thinking, well, maybe we should actually look into this. Maybe it is possible. So we started looking to try and find cabins and little kind of huts in quite well-known places. So Austria and throughout the French Alps, the Swiss Alps, these European ski areas, and everything was incredibly expensive. So then we started thinking, well, okay, well, how about looking a little bit further afield? So we broadened the search towards Eastern Europe, which is still kind of more under the radar. So we started looking at Serbia, we looked at Romania, we looked at Bulgaria. And during this part of the search, we eventually stumbled across Slovenia. And this Slovenia looked pretty interesting to us. We found this little cabin, which was pretty much the only one within our pretty small budget. So we decided to come to Slovenia for a week. We brought our tents with us, we hired a car, we drove around Slovenia for a week, and we were completely and utterly smitten. It just ticked all of our boxes. That it was this incredibly scenic country from a natural perspective. We found this little wooden cabin like up this mountain surrounded by like plum orchards and pine forest. And it was just everything, this rural, idyllic kind of dream. It was like everything we could have imagined. So there were some troubles beforehand, but we ended up in the end clubbing together to buy this little cabin, which was in need of a lot of work. It's 300 years old and it came with 300 problems. So that was the initial connection to Slovenia. Over the following years, I came back to Slovenia pretty much twice a year to work on the place, little by little, renovating it, repairing it, fixing it. And every time I came, I became more and more enamored with Slovenia. I met more people. I just thought, this is the place for me. But back then, I couldn't see any real way of making that a life because I was working for a startup at the time in Edinburgh. This was also before remote working. So the idea of being able to live somewhere different hadn't entered our consciousness really back then. Anyway, after 10 years, the planets kind of aligned after a breakup. The planets aligned to enable me to come and spend a bit of time here, which I did as a heartbroken hermit. I lived in this little cabin for a few months going into winter. It was very cold.
That's impossibly romantic. That's like Bronte epic scale, just like going up to the mountains and wintering your heights up in the mountains.
Yeah, I mean, I did. I really was up here all alone. It probably wasn't the best place to be, actually. After a big breakup, to be kind of on your own and in the freezing cold, chopping wood every day. But it gave me a bit of time to kind of patch my heart and think about, okay, what the hell do I do now? Where should I go? What should I do with my life? And I ended up deciding to stay in Slovenia because I thought, well, let's see where life goes here in Slovenia. And I think I would have still been living in Slovenia had I not met my Austrian wife.
Okay. What else has it been giving you as a writer of this area? You're covering things that most people don't know about. You're a writer and reporter for the Three Seas Initiative.
Yeah, that's right. The Three Seas Initiative, it's a sort of geopolitical block of countries in Central and Eastern Europe, which kind of got together several years ago to try to improve the connections between them in terms of business and infrastructure, but also how they're viewed in the world at large. And it's true that I think a lot of people think of Eastern Europe as being, there's still a big hangover from the Soviet times and communism, and actually a huge amount of misconceptions as well. I mean, Slovenia was not even ever part of the USSR, but most people think it was part of Russia. So this organization is partly trying to show that there's a huge amount of incredibly interesting things in terms of business and tech and leisure going on in this part of the world. So I write for them about interesting characters from this part of the world.
What is one thing that you would like people to know about this part of the world?
It's incredibly beautiful. I've been to a lot of different countries. I've been to Norway, I've been to New Zealand, I've lived in Japan, I've lived in Canada, I've been to India. But Slovenia is the most consistently beautiful country I've ever seen. There's so many times when I've been in this country where I've been driving down some little lane to some village and I've just had this stab of almost like shock of how striking the scenery is. This kind of perfect combination of natural beauty which has been improved by some little wooden building, some little barn on a hillside. It's just a very striking country aesthetically. But there's a side to it which I hadn't realized, and that was it's actually much more developed and advanced than you might imagine. People think of Yugoslavia, and probably the first thing they think of is the Yugoslavian wars during the 90s, which were horrific, but Slovenia escaped from that very early on and was not involved in any major fighting. There was something called the 10-day war. Slovenia declared independence. It kind of pulled out of Yugoslavia. There was some brief fighting, 10 days, and that was pretty much it. So it didn't get damaged like Bosnia did or Serbia did in that way. So I was really pleased and surprised to discover there was this thriving tech scene in Slovenia. There was a lot of blockchain companies. I ended up getting a job with a blockchain company when I came here. The level of English is incredibly high here. I was kind of shocked how good it is. I think all of my good friends speak English to a level of fluency that's normally only, I know, Scandinavians can speak that good English as a second language. Not to say that everyone does. Certainly in the rural areas, I converse with my kind of farmer neighbors in Slovenian. But the level of English is really high, and that enabled me to go deeper than I would have been able to had I been relying on my very basic Slovene.
What do you think that is? The way you describe it makes me want to go. What do you think that is in terms of development?
I think there's some historic element to it. So from what I gather, speaking to my Slovenian friends, even when Slovenia was part of Yugoslavia, it was always apparently the most sort of industrious and slightly more advanced in some ways, possibly due to its location, because it does border Austria, the more Germanic world, and Germany and Austria are more famed for being, you know, more organized and in that way, compared to, say, the further south you go, when you go down to Bosnia or Macedonia, there's a definite change. They're more laid back down there. They're more casual. So partly it could be due to that. Education was pretty good in Yugoslavia, by all accounts, and Slovenia just had some good institutions. Slovenia had some computing companies, so it produced quite a lot of good programming companies and software companies. I think the English question, because Slovenia is such a small country, it's 2 million people in the entire country. So Slovenians know that very few people will ever attempt to learn Slovenian, especially because it's not an easy language to learn.
It's a Slavic language, isn't it?
Yes, it's a Slavic language, which has complexities. If you're familiar with Slavic languages, then you wouldn't find it so difficult. But for me, it's not such an easy one. But because I think they know they're a small country, if you want to be part of the kind of global conversation, you need to speak English. And a lot of my Slovenian friends have told me they don't dub anything in Slovenia. So when they show a foreign film on Slovenian television, they don't dub it. Whereas in Austria or in France, they still dub it. Slovenia would just have the original language in English with a Slovenian subtitle. And most of my Slovenian friends attribute that as one of the big reasons why they speak English so fluently.
Okay. Yeah, Slovenia is part of the EU. Is that right? It would have been easier for people living in Europe to sort of be a digital nomads and just kind of move around in that area, in that part of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Slovenia was part of the EU. It's part of NATO. It's part of the Eurozone. So it was easy as anywhere else in the EU to move around and to work there. Yeah, if you have an EU passport.
Yeah. What prompted you to write a travel memoir about your time in Slovenia, about moving to Slovenia? Obviously, you've already written about your experiences in Japan. So what prompted the writing of this particular book?
Yeah, after the Japan book, I think I always had it in the back of my mind that I would like to write something about Slovenia. And because the Japan book had done quite well, it's now sold over 10,000 copies, it kind of spurred me on to look at writing something about Slovenia. And there's very, very little written in English about Slovenia. I mean, I can count on one hand the number of books that are written about life in Slovenia from a foreigner's perspective. I don't think there's even five books. I've inhaled them all. I mean, any book on Slovenia, I instantly read. So I wanted to contribute something to that world of my experiences in Slovenia and kind of take people around the country, show them what the people are like, show them what the landscape is like. And it kind of weaves a narrative of my life, kind of why I ended up moving there, how that happened, how I got to grips with a new language and the bureaucracy and all those things. As we both know, right, when you move to another country, there's other challenges. So it kind of, it brings all those things in. So it should appeal to people anyone who has any remote interest in Slovenia, anyone who likes reading kind of memoir or travel memoir, any armchair travelers as well, who are just intrigued to learn about other countries. I read a lot of memoirs about countries I'll almost certainly never visit, but I just enjoy hearing about them from that perspective of someone who's actually living there or has lived there. So I think most people think of Slovenia as being probably quite undeveloped, and they think of it as being possibly still a little bit war-torn or communist, but it's really not. I describe Slovenia as it's like the perfect melting pot, because you have the infrastructure and the level of development of kind of Western Europe. Everything pretty much runs on time. There's not great big lots of corruption or anything like that. You have high kind of alpine mountains. You have a coastline. So you have sort of Mediterranean coastline. And then you have this sort of sprinkling of Balkan spice, I say, which just makes it a little bit more laid back. So in my opinion, it's like this perfect mix, this sort of cultural and geographical intersection, which makes it unusual and unique. So as a tourist, it's getting around is no problem at all. Everyone speaks amazing English. It's very well set up for tourism, but it's still quite under visited, I would say. Not everywhere. Places like there's a very famous lake called Lake Bled. And if you've seen one picture of Slovenia, you've probably seen Lake Bled. It's like the picture which is on every single guidebook, or you know, Instagrammers go bonkers over it. So there are places now which are getting too busy, but there is still a lot of very, very beautiful parts of the country which are really barely visited at all.
Yeah, sounds like you might have to write another travel guide to best places to go to in Slovenia.
Well, that's an interesting point, because as someone who's written a lot about travel, I now have a big dilemma about it, because I've seen firsthand the damage that over-tourism can do. I briefly lived in Barcelona for a summer, and I really experienced how awful it was to have so many people, so many tourists coming to the city centre. And I also saw how the locals reacted to that. I remember seeing stickers on lampposts saying, Airbnb, fuck off, and you know, no tourists go home, and this sort of thing. And it changed my opinion of how we should visit places. And I can totally understand it from a local's point of view. If you don't benefit directly from tourism, then all of these hundreds of thousands of tourists just get in the way, they push the prices up. There's no benefit to you. It's only really a downside. So it changed my opinion of writing about places. Slovenia is actually the first place I didn't want to write about, because I could see it was somewhere so special that I didn't want to tell the mass market.
How do you think would be a good way to have responsible tourism to sort of manage that if possible?
The problem is, or one of the problems associated with tourism, that people are not always very imaginative. One thing I'm not a fan of is, and Instagram, I think, has really made this very bad. You get some famous spot. This happens in Slovenia. There's some beautiful lookouts over this lake I told you about, Lake Bled. You know, one person takes a picture on Instagram, then everyone wants to go and take the same picture, the same contrived picture of someone staring out over the mountains. I really dislike this type of tourism. So I think people should think more carefully about what they share. On the other side, who am I, you know, someone who comes from the UK, who am I to say that Slovenia shouldn't have more tourists? You know, there's plenty of people in Slovenia who would love to have more tourists. And I think if it's done right, if you do try and spread out the tourists more, that's the right approach. And indeed, that is the approach that Slovenia are taking. I know someone who works for the Slovenian Tourist Board, and the strategy they want to do is they want to try and make people stay longer in Slovenia, but go to more places and not just go to Lake Bled or just go to Ljubljana for a day or two. They want to try and draw those people out and show them all of the other amazing places in the country so it's not so concentrated.
You want people to really know the country and know the culture, right? Ideally, you'd want people to sort of go off the beaten track if possible and get an appreciation, understanding of the country, even if it's for a short experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It also depends on what you're into, right? Yeah, to be fair, some people do just want to go and sit on a beach in Spain for 2 weeks and get some sun. Like, that's okay. I'm not a beach guy. I've never been particularly interested in that. I just get sunburnt. So I've always been more interested in trying to go a little bit deeper. I find, especially in this area and also where I was in Japan, these more rural places, I do find it fascinating to see ways of life which in the UK have generally disappeared. So for example, here in Slovenia, I got involved with people making schnapps, for example. You know, I wanted to see that process, how they shape the trees, collect the plums, and then they actually let them ferment, and then they distill the schnapps. There's all sorts of other interesting things in Slovenia. For example, one guy I met some years ago is a dormice hunter.
What?
So, yeah. So I'd never heard of this either until I dug a bit deeper into Slovenia. But there are these little creatures. They look a bit like grey squirrels. They're called dormice. And they actually are called edible. Hence the name of the book. Yes, yeah. That's the connection. In South Slovenia, there's an ancient tradition of hunting and eating the dormice, because back to kind of hundreds of years ago, the landowners didn't permit the poor peasants to hunt any of the bigger game. So they weren't allowed to hunt deer. They weren't allowed to hunt wild boar. The only animals they allowed the poor people to hunt were these little dormice. So this culture grew up around that, of trapping these small dormice and eating their meat, using their fur to make hats and coats, and using their oil. So there's things like that which I found fascinating, these kind of old ways of life. And that's a lot of the book, Dormice and Moonshine, is kind of me discovering this way of life, which is perhaps more in keeping with the natural world than my own upbringing in the UK. And that's something which drew me to Slovenia and also drew me to rural Japan.
Yeah. I was going to say that. Like, I do remember one thing that struck me was how seasonal and regional everything is in Australia. Fruits, for example, you can have apples all year round because they keep them in cold storage, right? So you can have them out of season. In Japan, they're very traditional in the sense that, no, you can only have this fruit within this particular season. If you have it outside of that season, it's completely wrong and the whole world will just, I don't know, burst into flames or something like that. It's just not on. It's just not done, right? And I was actually talking to a friend about this the other day, about how you really get sense of the seasons passing, of time passing. And that sort of rhythm of life, it's comforting. It's very unexpected. I don't know how quite to explain it, but when you have sort of like phases of the year bookmarked by visual cues like that, it's somehow a very comforting thing. You probably can put that in a better way than I could, but that's one thing I really liked about my time in Japan.
Yeah, you've made a really good point and you've hit the nail on the head. I actually talk about this a little bit in my Japan book, but you're really right. There's this sense of, almost a sense of sadness, I think, in Japan, where every moment is fleeting. You know, like the hanami, the sakura, like this idea that it's this incredible beauty, but it passes and dies and withers. Everything is fleeting. Nothing lasts forever. And therefore must be enjoyed to the full in the moment.
Yes.
And I think it's a real key point, right? Like the Japanese have got something right about that. Yes, of course they could also put their fruit in the cold storage, but probably on the whole they don't. Maybe they do now, I'm not sure. But I also like it. I like this sense of, I don't think we should have, if you have complete abundance all the time, then you don't appreciate it. So I think it heightens the sense of appreciation for certain times of year, for certain foods and for certain events. And it's not so different here in Slovenia as well.
I really like the description of having things happen in the moment makes you more appreciative of that moment because it's not going to last forever. I'm sure there's a word for it. I mean, I'm going to sound like a wanker, but the sadness is what makes things more beautiful, something like that.
It's true. And I don't think you sound like a wanker at all. Yeah, I agree with that. I used to think that the UK had, or at least England, where I grew up, had seasons. Of course we have seasons, you know, like everyone else. But when I went to Japan, I was like, oh, actually, we don't have seasons in the UK. Because in Japan, I really saw this much more extreme weather, you know, very hot summers, very cold winters. And that also gives you this sense of movement, because just as you're kind of getting used to the summer humidity, it starts to fade into autumn, and then you get the trees. And then just as you've kind of had enough of autumn, the first snow arrives on the mountain, and so on. And it gives this rhythm of life, this kind of this idea that you're flowing through life, you are moving through it, rather than just sitting in a stagnant pond, floating but not moving.
Yeah. I wanted to now go somewhere a little bit different and talk about other interesting aspects of your career. Fashion design. I find it really interesting that you actually started, like, would it be fair to call it a fashion label?
I think that's overblowing it. Yes.
How did that start? Yeah.
So I created a line of graphic design t-shirts, Slovenian inspired graphic design t-shirts, which you can see at bregdesign.com. I'm not a graphic designer, but I had the ideas and the concept. So I quite like graphic t-shirts. I'd actually designed one back in Japan as well. Towards the end of my stay of those 2 years in Fukui Prefecture, I wanted to kind of buy a nice kind of cool graphic design t-shirt about Fukui, but I couldn't find any in Fukui. I looked in lots of shops. There was nothing interesting to me. So I thought, well, I'll have a go at making my own. So I teamed up with a fellow jet of mine who was an artist. I came up with a concept, I sketched it out on paper, and then she kind of neatened it up. And we did a run of t-shirts. I think we ended up selling like several hundred because there was no one else doing it. So I had a little bit of a background in this. A similar situation occurred in Slovenia. I was trying to find some nice, cool t-shirts. I couldn't find any. All I could find were very cliche, kind of tourist, tacky ones. And I'd already seen there were so many interesting aspects of Slovenian culture and language and landscape that I knew that I could play with and create some interesting designs. So I decided to do that. Got my sketchbook, sketched everything out in pencil, loads of ideas, refined them, worked with some different graphic designers to create the final actual files, and then, yeah, printed them on t-shirts. Unfortunately, I started just before the pandemic hit, so it wasn't the best time to start that. But that was, 3 years ago. And now I have some selling in some shops in Slovenia and also via a print-on-demand partner. So you can buy them anywhere in the world and they'll be printed locally to you. So that's how it started.
Cool. In Fukushima, one of the local fundraiser projects that the Fukushima Jets community did was to print tea as well. It's a sort of a spin on the Isle of New York thing. It had the local mascot, the Akabeko, which is a red cow that's sort of drawn very cartoonishly, sort of vaguely looks like a heart, and then Fukushima in kanji. Was it difficult to start up like a t-shirt brand? Was it daunting, or you just found yourself selling them online kind of thing?
It was a bit more than that. Like, I thought there was a gap in the market. So I knew from living in Ljubljana that there was nothing that I would buy t-shirt wise. And I thought, well, if I want to buy a cool t-shirt, then probably other people would. So I did set out with more of a business mindset to fill a niche. And it was an interesting journey because I'm not a graphic designer myself. I had the concepts and I can sketch a crude kind of pencil drawing and then color it in, but I couldn't make it a finished file. So at first there was the challenge of just finding some graphic designers to work with, which sounds easy, but actually wasn't as easy as you might expect. But eventually I did. Then I had to try and find a printer. And again, this is in the context of being in another country. And although I said that most Slovenians do speak pretty good English, which is true, not everyone does. So it's sometimes there are challenges, for example, finding a decent printer. The one I found didn't speak English, which made conversation a bit more tricky, but it was great practice for my Slovenian. And then it was the challenge of, well, how do I get these into shops? So for a while, I was like a traveling salesman. I had a car boot full of t-shirts. And I just drove around Slovenia. And when I went to a town, I saw a shop which looked like it might be the sort of place that might sell them. I just went in and asked the owner and spoke to the owner. And a lot of them said no. Some of them said yes. And that's how I kind of built it. But then there was other challenges after that. You know, it's there's a lot more admin involved than I perhaps appreciated. A lot of it was quite frustrating. But now it's at a point where it's just it's a side project. It's a sideline, but it's kind of set up that it sort of runs itself to some extent.
Yeah.
So, and I want to add a whole, I've got so many more ideas. I need to get around to doing them, like a whole new set of set designs. So maybe in 2024, I'll do those.
The other aspect I wanted to talk about is, how did you get into the whole tech startup side of things?
Yeah, so the transition was definitely related to my experience in JET. In Japan, I began to write. I think like a lot of JETs do, they probably write a blog. I was one of those guys, but I kept it going. I think a lot of people start a blog and then finish. But I was so inspired by the life that I was living. And it was so easy to write because it was always something fascinating to me. And it was a great way to practice my writing and sort of hone it over those 2 years. But after, well, during that time in Japan, I wanted more in terms of writing. So I started pitching my ideas to magazines, travel magazines and things. And after many, many rejections, I finally got an editor who said, yeah, we'll buy this story that you pitch. And that was a big turning point because suddenly I could see, okay, well, if I can sell one, then I can sell two. And if I can sell two, I can sell 10. So that led to this kind of path towards the writing. However, when I returned to the UK, the job I got was actually with a kind of an internet marketing agency, and it involved a bit of writing. It wasn't a full writing job, but it involved someone who had a bit of writing experience. And in that agency, I learned a lot about search engine optimization, SEO, internet marketing. And then that's how I got the job, the next step into this, which was at the time just a small startup called Skyscanner. It's a flight website.
Yes, I've used them before. Yes.
Yeah. So back then, it was just a little startup. There was like 10 people in the country. It actually started in Edinburgh in Scotland. I joined them, and that turned into an incredible ride, which I couldn't have foreseen, because it just rapidly grew from 10 people. When I left, there was 1,000. And over the 9 years that I stayed there, it was like working for like 5 different companies, because it expanded so rapidly, and there was always new exciting things to take on and to be challenged with. And we grew geographically into other regions of the world and stuff. It was a very, very exciting time. And that's where I really kind of learned all about content marketing and just jumping into things and having to do things that you didn't know anything about, because that's the way that startups worked.
Yeah. Skyscanner. Yeah. When I saw Skyscanner on your LinkedIn, I was like, no fucking way. JETs are like pretty amazing how they're connected to a lot of aspects of pop culture. I always joke that JETs or the alumni is a little bit like a friendlier form of the Illuminati kind of thing. You know, we've got our fingers in pies, all different areas of the world. If we really tried to, we probably could be like a secret society, but I think we're just too nice. Side note, Switzerland just started on JET chapter. I know that's not that close to you, but probably the closest. What is the closest? Oh, Germany. German JET AA. There's a few in Austria. France. It's like I said, it's the Illuminati all over the world. Indonesia's got a fledgling JET AA chapter. Philippines just got ratified. And it's kind of ironic, really, with all these new chapters forming, because we're seeing a fall in memberships across the world, because it's not like years ago back then where people didn't have other ways like we do now with the internet of accessing the Japan fix. And the JET AA chapters were set up back in 1989 because there was no other way of actually maintaining that Japanese connection. Maybe we now need to pivot into more career and life support and mentoring. So many of the young ones, it's funny, so young. So many of the young ones are stressing out. It can be like, from this point forward, you know, Japan's the peak. Now it's just going down the slope. It's a slow slide down to the grave kind of thing, sort of thing. That kind of like, kind of a slow calm down from a chemical high.
It's very apt that you should describe it that way, because I remember when I first came back from Japan and I came back to the UK, I really did crash down. Those 2 years were very, very impactful on me. And even now, 20 years on, it's really etched on me, those 2 years. It was a very, very powerful experience. And I really did crash down when I came back to the UK. I came back to rainy Scotland. The weather was awful. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I sort of fell into a bit of a, I guess, a mild kind of depression.
Yeah.
So, however, there is obviously there's light at the end of the tunnel, and you know, you will go on to climb higher mountains. I think Jet was always something which went down well at the interviews when I was interviewing for various roles, because it's something different. It makes you stand out. It shows, it's a clear demonstration that you are brave enough to step into the unknown, and you can roll with the punches, and you can handle difficult, complex, intercultural exchanges. For me, I didn't do anything related to Japan, and I didn't do anything related to teaching. But even so, there are lots of transferable skills. At Skyscanner, I had my own team of 12 people by the end of it. I'd hired lots of people interviewing, and maybe I was biased, but I would often favor those people that had got a bit of real world experience. They'd gone out of their comfort zone. They worked abroad somewhere, not necessarily on Jet, because to me, it showed a sort of level of adventurousness and entrepreneurialism. There's a certain drive and curiosity about the world, which unites a lot of Jets. And I guess that's why probably they do go on to have interesting careers, because as we alluded to earlier, not everyone would take the jump to just go to another country and tackle another language. So if you've done that and you've got the kind of balls to do it, you're probably going to go on to do some other interesting things later on. But that you've always got that if you've done Jet. On your other point about how societies or associations like JAA will age, that's a really interesting point. When I came back from Japan in Scotland, for a while, I was involved with the Japan Society of Scotland. And I was seeing it almost one generation on, because they were basically a bunch of people who were probably most of them retired or in their mid-60s, who'd been in Japan during the big 80s boom years. So they were these bankers and insurance kind of brokers that went over and enjoyed the sort of Tokyo boom years. And then they'd come back and set up this society. But I could see it didn't really offer so much for the younger generation, who didn't need to go to an annual society dinner, or they would just talk on Facebook. So I guess, you guys are now facing a similar challenge. And how do you like modernize? How do you deliver value to the next generation?
Yeah. How do you reach them? I mean, you know, Facebook is like no longer a thing that they're using. Like, they're leaving Facebook in droves. They're all like on TikTok. And like, I don't want to use TikTok. Like, it's just the idea of that just sounds exhausting. And, you know, you and I working in the tech industry, I don't know about you, but for me, I definitely have an extra sort of neuroticism or wariness about security and privacy. I don't want to push too much of myself out there, which the next generation will, they don't have a problem with that. But privacy? What's that? Is it a kind of a dish? I don't know.
Do you think the pendulum will swing back, though? So I totally agree. Like, I'm also careful about privacy, and social networks are definitely have a lot of inherent dangers with oversharing. Do you think the pendulum will swing back? So in the same way that other things that we now see as very harmful, like smoking, but at one time was considered healthy, you know, even doctors apparently smoke a cigarette a day. It makes it keeps your lungs healthy. Like, you can actually see genuine adverts that were saying that, you know, back in the 50s or whatever. And now, of course, we can see the impact that's had after decades. And I wonder whether social media will go through that same, or maybe already is going through that same realization that there are also downsides and health issues with this. And it will come with health warnings in future. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. It's hard to tell. I've spoken to people who do the digital detox, like they close their Facebook, their IG, their TikTok, or their whatever, because they have to get away from it all. There are discussions and programs trying to educate and manage the consumption because of the mental health consequences. But then on the other hand, you've got people who just like desperately want to be the next big, I don't know, Mr. Beast or whatever kind of thing. Like my teenage nephew, when he was 10, he said like his ambition was to be a social media influencer. I don't know. It's really hard to say.
Also, I think we need to look at it for a bigger lens as well. So for me, being older and then seeing social media come in, and like you say, your nephew, that's his dream. But I remember my parents always telling me to not watch as much TV, and television will rot your brain. And, and I guess everyone back then, they wanted to be an actor, you know, be a screen star,
yeah,
or a model or whatever. So I think every generation or every couple of generations, there'll be a big technological advancement, which will create a brand new way of consuming media.
Mm.
And of course, that'll influence the next generation. And I, you know, the old generation always look back on the youngsters a little bit, and it wasn't like that in my day. And we always think that our way was better. But of course, my parents think that their way was better by and large. So I think if we look at it in that lens as well, maybe sometimes we over demonize the evils of social media. I don't know. I still am not a fan. In general, I think there's a lot of dangers with constantly seeking validation from the number of likes you get on a picture. I think this is definitely not a healthy way to live your life in general. But maybe it's not as bad as I think.
Yeah, with every new invention, technology that changes the way we communicate, there's always a little bit of friction, and people say, oh, this is a downfall of society as we know it, when what they really mean is this is the end of a world in which I have been relevant. I think actually the younger generation is much more savvy about the dangers of the internet. And sure, I mean, that's a generalization. Like they still you know, fall victim to, say, scams or whatever, but they have an understanding of stuff like ghosting or whatever. And they've got like this whole new language of etiquette, a whole new sort of way, method of wordless communication, of like interpreting actions and reading between the lines that we are not aware of, right? So I think each new generation comes up with a way of coping. They can have a sophisticated viewpoint. It's just that they're sheltered. They just don't have the weight and experience of having lived a few decades behind them to properly polish and form the opinions. I may be too optimistic, but yeah, that gives me that kind of optimism for the next generation.
Yeah, at the end of the day, we turned out all right, I think. Despite the predictions of, you know, TV rotting your brain or whatever it was, computer games were also often came under fire, right, from parents. And again, there is definitely, I don't agree that you should be playing computer games every single hour of your life. You know, you need a balance of things. You need to get outside. You do need to do exercise. But with each of these new technologies, there's always going to be pros and cons, and it comes down to the balance of how you use it. And I think you hit the point well, saying that every generation kind of says this is the end of the world because it's actually just the end of your world. The next generation, it's kind of inevitable that social media will or already is becoming the main way that that generation communicates and learns and socializes. And you can kind of either just ignore it, or you can maybe try and use it to your advantage or get involved a little bit in moderation, you know. So I think every generation has to learn how to deal or cope with the next big jump in technology.
My work colleague is 21. I call him my youth consultant. Like, if something happens and I see on IG and Instagram, I would say, hey, Zach, I don't understand this joke. As a youth consultant, can you please explain to me? And he's just like, oh, yeah, sure. And blah, 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 blah. Even my friend who's like 29, she says half the stuff she doesn't get anymore. It's just, yeah, I don't know what the point of that story is, but it's just, yeah, in terms of like how so different, how quick, how fast the churn of communication is. It's just, oh my God, yeah.
You get left behind, but I guess it would be the same. You know, I remember when me and my brothers speaking certain new slang words in the playground because they were the coolest words, and my parents wouldn't know what they meant. So I think it's something which is it's an ongoing part of kind of the way that life just evolves.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to end with apart from buy the book or you will die kind of thing? You know? How's that for a market?
That's it's strong. Let me say one thing. I think one of the things that Japan showed me is every day was an adventure into the unknown. in Japan, right? Every day was exciting because almost always you were learning something new, whether that just be a new Japanese word or you spotted a new bizarre product on the shelf in the local supermarket. But it meant that every day was interesting and kind of kept you alive. And I think that's another lesson that I would take back. And perhaps that's why I've ended up living in various other countries. Maybe I needed that to explore and be somewhere which was slightly out of my comfort zone to be stimulated and to learn. So again, maybe there's a lesson there, like try to put yourself into new places and new situations, because then life feels more like an adventure.
My thanks to Sam for being a great guest. I wish we had more time to get into other aspects of his career, but like all fun things, we get sidetracked into many a rabbit hole. And if you are intrigued as I am about this place he calls Slovenia, check out his website on sambaldwin.me to get updates on when his book Dormice and Windshine comes out. Until next time, I wish you a good journey to all the places you'll go. See you soon. Music for this episode is Snowdrift by Holizna CCO from the album Winter Lo-Fi, with public domain license and sourced from freemusicarchive.org. The Afterjet podcast is generously supported by the Council of Local Authorities for International Relations, or CLARE, but is otherwise an independent personal project by me, Eden Law. All views and opinions expressed on this podcast are the personal opinions of podcast participants and are not the official views of any organization that participants are part of, connected with, or work for.